Published in 1936, Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind remains one of the best-selling novels of all time. Ask anyone with even a passing knowledge of the book or the movie, and they're likely to pinpoint Scarlett O'Hara, an equally mesmerizing and manipulative Southern belle, as the main character in this book. However, those with a deeper familiarity of Mitchell's work may be able to point to a character even more essential to the heart of this novel than Scarlett herself. Tara, which is the name of the plantation that serves as the O'Hara family home. We're given a sense of the deep significance of the theme of land in Mitchell's work when early on, a petulant young Scarlett scoffs at her father's reminder that she will one day inherit the family home. At that point, Scarlett was so bothered by that which she did not currently have, namely a Mr. Ashley Wilkes, that she couldn't see the value of that which she did have. Troubled by his daughter's reaction, Gerald O'Hara turns his daughter to face him and says, "Do you mean to tell me, Katie Scarlett O'Hara, that Tara, that land doesn't mean anything to you? Why, land is the only thing in this world worth working for, worth fighting for, worth dying for, because it's the only thing that lasts. The importance of land, of the earth, of the ground upon which we set our feet, we build our homes, and we live our lives is an essential and an enduring part of the human experience. It's something that has been embedded in our hearts by the Creator, by the one who formed us from the dust of the ground, to which Scripture teaches we will all eventually return. Much like the plantation, Tara plays a central role in Mitchell's Gone with the Wind. The land of Canaan plays a central role in the book of Joshua. For much of the narrative, it serves as the backdrop. It's the setting upon which the action occurs. But in this week of Scripture, the land itself will take center stage. Now, of course, there's a trick to it, because given that it's land, it speaks no lines and it performs no actions. So we will have to lean in close and listen very carefully to see what the Lord has to teach us through the land. But I am convinced that if we can do those things, it will be a very fruitful week of study for us. So we are going to begin tonight in Joshua chapter 13, verse 1. Joshua was now old, advanced in age, and the Lord said to him, "You have become old, advanced in age, but a great deal of the land remains to be possessed." Last week, in the summary of conquest provided in chapter 11, we read that Joshua and the Israelites battled and waged war against the Canaanites for a long time. So as we pick up in chapter 13, we see that much time has passed and Joshua is now an old man. So old, apparently, that the Lord had to remind him that he was old, which I think means that you're pretty old. But all of this seems to be according to plan, because back in Exodus chapter 23, the Lord had foretold, "I will not drive them out ahead of you in a single year. Otherwise, the land would become desolate and wild animals would multiply against you. I will drive them out little by little ahead of you until you have become numerous and take possession of the land." The conquest of the land was a vast endeavor. It was not going to happen overnight in a few swift military campaigns, but would be a strategic and an ongoing process. As the text of chapter 13 continues, we're given a sense of how much progress the Israelites had made in conquering the land and how much work still remained undone. And that map on page 165 of your study guide provided you with a helpful visual representation of this. So you can see that all of those areas that are shaded a light gray is an approximation of the land that was not yet conquered. God assures Joshua of his continuing commitment to go before the Israelites and drive the inhabitants out of the land, and he tells Joshua what he is to do next in verse 7. God says, "Therefore, divide the land as an inheritance to the 9 tribes and the half tribe of Manasseh." So in order for you to understand the importance of this job that Joshua has been assigned here, you need to see that the Israelites' actions in regard to the land of Canaan were quite necessarily divided up into several different steps or stages. So first, they had to enter the land, which we saw was just a great ordeal in and of itself. And then they had to conquer the land by driving out the inhabitants who lived there. Then they had to divide the land so that finally every individual tribe could go in and take possession of or settle the portion that they were in charge of. So when the Israelites came into the land of Canaan, they did so as one big unified force in order to establish and to secure a stronghold in the heart of the land. But then there came a point when, in order to get the job done, they had to, you've heard the terminology, divide and conquer, so that every tribe could then go in, settle their portion, and drive out any of the inhabitants that lived where they were to settle down. So now that we've taken care of that, let's take some time tonight to do just a little bit of math. So there are 12 tribes, but God directs Joshua in verse 7 to divide the land as an inheritance to 9.5 of them. So what's that about? This may be a review for some of you, but I think that it will be worth our time to kind of get our head straight regarding how we get to the 12 tribes that actually receive an inheritance. So you're going to be tempted to say, well, we get the 12 tribes because of the 12 sons of Jacob or Israel. And that's right, in part, but it is a little bit more complicated than that. So Jacob did indeed have 12 sons, but the tribe of his son Levi, per the instruction of the Lord, did not receive an inheritance of land. And that's because the Levites played a special role amongst the tribe of Israel. They were the ones who served as priests. They oversaw the sacrifices and the offerings that were made in the tabernacle. They were in charge of the tabernacle and all of its elements. So because they had this special role, the Lord provided for them in a specific and special way. They got their daily food from the offerings that the Israelites made at the tabernacle. The Lord gave them cities to live in, and he also gave them constant work and service to him. So the Lord said that he himself would be their inheritance. So it's not that they didn't receive an inheritance, they just received a different type of inheritance. So the Levites did not receive an inheritance of land. So when we exclude the Levites, we're now down to the 11 tribes who receive an inheritance of land. But back in Genesis chapter 48, Jacob gave his son Joseph a double portion inheritance. So that meant that he got one portion for each of Joseph's two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. So then that's how we get back up to 12 tribes who are receiving an inheritance of land. So if you've got your brain wrapped around that, then I want to take a moment and discuss the pesky little matter of these half-tribes that we have running around. It confused me to no end what these half-tribes were all about for the longest time. So let's review this as well. As some of you may remember, back in the book of Numbers, when the whole lot of Israel was making their way toward the land of promise, the tribes of Reuben and Gad and part of the tribe of Manasseh started talking, and they kind of decided that they really liked the land where they currently were. Now, bear in mind, they were not yet in the land of promise. They were still east of the Jordan River. They were on their way to the land of promise. But nonetheless, these tribes decided that they wanted this land as an inheritance. So they go to Moses and they ask him, and really long story short, eventually, Moses agrees to it. So that is why we have Manasseh East and Manasseh West. So half of the tribe of Manasseh had already received their inheritance, along with the tribes of Reuben and Gad, east of the Jordan River, which Moses divided up before he died. So that is why we have God telling Joshua here in 13:7 to divide the land as an inheritance to just 9.5 tribes, because these were the tribes that were receiving their inheritance in the actual land of God's promise, which was the territory that was west of the Jordan River. And then for the next 6 chapters of scripture, that is exactly what Joshua does. He divides up the land as an inheritance to these 9.5 tribes. And I know that reading those 5 chapters of that segment that were assigned to you this week was every bit as exciting to you ladies as reading a survey of land. So I will agree that on the surface, this material is a little bit dry, but I can also tell you that when I come up against a portion of scripture like this one that is a little bit boring and tedious and really difficult to get through, I always do so now with a bit of anticipation, because I know that all scripture is inspired by the Lord, and I know that it is useful. It is for our instruction and for our conviction and for our correction and for training us up in righteousness. And in certain sections of scripture, it is really easy for us to look and see and pick out what is so good for us there. But in other portions of scripture, like this one, it is really difficult to see, but I know that it's there. So it becomes an adventure, kind of like a treasure hunt, and I get to go with the Lord, and he helps me find what is there. So let's go hunting tonight, and let's see what we can find. So the first thing that I want you to see from this section of scripture is how intimately acquainted the Lord is with his people's inheritance. So in case you kind of glazed over a time or two when you were reading through this material, the amount of detail that the Lord gave in regards to this was absolutely stunning. I want you to see that God's promises to his people were specific, it was concrete, it was tangible, it was real. Hebrews 11:8 says that when God first called Abraham to go out to the land that he would one day give him as an inheritance, Abraham went out not even really knowing what he was doing or where he was going. Abraham had nothing more than some vague notion of what his inheritance from the Lord was going to be, but Abraham left everything in pursuit of it because he trusted the one who was giving it. Abraham somehow had an understanding that although he did not hold all the details of his inheritance, that the Lord held every detail in hand, and we see that so clearly in this section of scripture. I mean, the Lord described this inheritance so precisely. Like, once I started to pick up on it, I had to go all the way back to the beginning just so I could circle every single word that he used. And I saw that God's inheritance to his people consisted of seas and bays and brooks and coastlines, of cities, of villages, of settlements, of mountains and valleys and hills and slopes and ravines. And the Lord knew every square inch of it. I remember holding each of my newborn babies in my arms and just inspecting every single inch of their little bodies, like lightly touching every single tiny finger and toe and running my head over their hair and over their scalp and running my finger over the slope of their little nose. I just wanted so desperately to commit every single detail of their tiny form to my memory, but my human head was not capable of retaining all of that, but God's is. And here, I think we see such gorgeous evidence that he does. And I think that this is so important for us to bear in mind. We need to know that God's inheritance for us is specific, it is concrete, it is tangible. It is real. It is not obscure or abstract or esoteric. I think sometimes as Christians, we get a little into over-spiritualizing things, and I don't want us to do this here because God's inheritance for us is real. And like Abraham, we do not have a lot of details regarding what this inheritance is. When we were writing the study, we searched. We wanted to be able to look up what is this inheritance going to be like, but we're simply not given a lot of information. And I'm convinced now, on the other side of writing this study and going through the material, that one of the reasons why the Lord doesn't provide us with a lot of details is because it's an invitation for us to allow our imaginations to run wild. Because he knows that whatever we dream up is not going to come close to what he actually has for us. As scripture says, no eye has seen, no ear has heard, no mind has imagined what God has prepared for those who love him. And I think that we just need to trust him in that. The second thing that I want you to see is this text is that when it comes to the promises of God, there is very often an element both of the Lord giving and of the people taking. And I think that's something else that we see very clearly in this section of scripture. We have also seen that in absence of either of those two elements, it just doesn't seem to work very well. So a very good example of that was back in Numbers, when in chapter 13 and 14, we saw that God was going to give the old generation of Israelites the land of promise. It was for them. He was giving it to them, but they refused to take it. And so then God determined that he wasn't going to give his promise to a people who weren't willing to take it. And then they got panicky and they decided, okay, never mind, we'll go in and take it. But by that point, the Lord wasn't willing to give it. So what lesson can we learn from that? I think that we need to understand that just like the Israelites, we also stand to forfeit any promise of God that we are not willing to reach out and take. And to feel the present force of that, I want you to understand that the promises that God has made us are not all intended for the great hereafter. Some of his promises are very much meant for our right now. We can have fruitful and abundant lives during our time on this earth, but we must take it. We can have peace, but we must take it. We can have rest from the burdens of this world, but we must take it. We have promise of everything that we need to live a godly life while we are here, but we must take it. So I think it's worth us just pausing to consider of these, of God's promises that he intends for our here and our now, which have you taken? Are there any that maybe you've just outright rejected? And where does more work remain? I mean, certainly none of us are masters of this domain. All of us have work that remains to be done. And I think that that is the next really big thing that this text offers us. So the third thing that I took from this week's scripture, I think one of the most troubling things that I noticed, and I certainly hope that it stood out to you as well, is this: the Israelites' repeated failure to completely drive out the inhabitants of the land. So I don't know if you guys interact with scripture in the same way that I do, but I kind of tend to talk back to the book as it talks to me. So as I'm reading, every time this week, I came across an instance where it said that the Israelites did not drive out, or they could not drive out, the inhabitants of the land. I just had to let them know exactly how I felt about that. No, oh, guys, right? Like, it was literally painful for me every time I came up against one of those verses. And surely we can have a little bit of sympathy for the Israelites. I mean, at this point, they had been battling for such a long time, and we know that there is always this tendency for us to let up in those battles that we have been fighting for such a long time, but to do so is absolutely fraught with danger. Because remember, the Lord had prepared them for this. He had said back in Exodus chapter 23 that he would drive out the inhabitants of the land little by little, and that is exactly how the Israelites were to proceed, little by little, until the job was done. Because he had also warned them of what was going to happen if they failed to do this. But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land, they will allow you, those you allow to remain, will become barbs in your eyes and thorns in your sides. They will give you trouble. Do not let them live in the land, or they will cause you to sin against me. And not to ruin the story for any of you in here who haven't already read ahead, but as we continue on in the biblical narrative, into the book of Judges and beyond, we are going to see that that is exactly what happens. Because the Israelites failed to drive their enemy out little by little, we see that little by little, the influence of the enemy infects and it poisons the people of God until they, in turn, are the ones that the Lord drives out of the land. So as I was trying to find a good way to apply this to my own life, I came across a quote by commentator Del Ralph Davis that I found to be really helpful. He writes, "Incomplete obedience brings no immediate crisis. It seldom does. However, here is testimony to all God's people. We frequently and strangely prove faithful in the great crises of faith, remain steadfast in severe storms, perhaps even relish the excitement of the heaviest assaults, yet lack the tenacity, the dogged endurance, the patient plodding often required in the prosaic affairs of believing life. We are often loath to be faithful in what we regard as little." God's entire plan for our lives is one that quite practically works out little by little. So again, I think it's worth pausing and just considering where you might have let up regarding the territory that you very well know the enemy still holds possession of in your life. We are to be faithful to God's little by little plan. The final thing I took from this week's text of scripture were the portraits of faith that we are given throughout. All throughout this text, we are given brief glimpses into the faith of a few specific individuals and tribes. So the most obvious and the most striking portrait of faith that we're provided with this week is that of Caleb's. Now, his was the very first inheritance to be given out in the actual land of God's promise, and we're going to read of it in chapter 14. Verse 6, "The descendants of Judah approached Joshua at Gilgal, and Caleb said to him, 'You know what the Lord promised Moses, the man of God, at Kadesh Barnea about you and me? I was 40 years old when Moses, the Lord's servant, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to scout the land, and I brought back an honest report. My brothers who went with me caused the people to lose heart, but I followed the Lord my God completely. On that day, Moses swore to me, 'The land where you have set your foot will be an inheritance for you and your descendants forever, because you have followed the Lord my God completely. As you see, the Lord has kept me alive these 45 years as he promised. Here I am today, 85 years old, and I am still as strong as the day Moses sent me out. Now give me the hill country the Lord promised me on that day, because you heard then that the Anakim live there as well, and they are in large fortified cities. Perhaps the Lord will be with me, and I will drive them out as the Lord has promised.'" Caleb was, alongside Joshua, the only other person who had experienced firsthand God's redemption out of the land of Egypt, who crossed into the land of promise, and for 45 years, he had held on to that hope of his inheritance. Now, I want you to bear in mind that the first 40 of those years were spent wandering around in the wilderness alongside the rebellious majority. And then the last 5 of those years had been spent in constant, embittered battle. So you can imagine that there would have been many an opportunity for Caleb to get a little bit cranky or a little bit bitter or discouraged concerning that inheritance that the Lord had promised him all of those years ago. But if he had a bad day, we see no hint of it in the text of Scripture. So you notice that when it came time for him to get his inheritance, he was not shy about it. He goes right up to Joshua and he says, "Now you give me that land that the Lord has promised me." And I think that we need to be more like Caleb. Caleb knew what God's promise to him was, and he had every intention of taking up God on that offer. Now notice, he didn't demand anything that the Lord hadn't already promised him, but he sure as heck was not going to miss out on that which the Lord said he was to receive. I mean, that's convicting to me. I feel like I almost constantly run the risk of becoming just a little bit lackadaisical when it comes to those things that the Lord has promised me. There's this statement that Jesus makes in Matthew chapter 11 that has just haunted me, like, since the moment I read it. It's one of those verses that are almost always just right under the surface of my skin. I can't shake it from my mind. And like many of the things that Jesus said, it's a little bit confusing at first, so we're going to have to work just a little to understand it. But I think that it's worth it, because I think that this might be a verse that sticks with you as well. In Matthew 11:12, Jesus says, "The kingdom of heaven has suffered violence, and the violent take it by force." Now, this verse is a perfect example of how sometimes we want to get just comfortable with jumping in and digging a little beneath the surface of Scripture. Because when I first read this verse, it felt a little uncomfortable to me. Like, I don't want to be that person. I mean, we've been taught that we're not supposed to take things by force. It's one of the first things that I teach my boys when they were playing with other children. So I don't want to be that person. But that term, "take it by force," is treated differently in different translations. Some translate it as "press into it," and some say "enter into it violently," or perhaps "raided it." But all of those translations are from a Greek word that describes an army storming a city in a desperate attempt to gain entry. So when we read that verse that Jesus spoke with the original meaning of that word in mind, it carries with it this notion of men storming their way into heaven as troops would storm their way into a city. One commentator writes that the violent are men of eager, impetuous zeal who grasp the kingdom of heaven, its peace and its pardon and its blessedness with as much eagerness as men would snatch and carry off as their own the spoils from a conquered city. That is the kind of eagerness that Caleb have, and this is the type of eagerness that's going to mark any of us who go out to receive the inheritance that the Lord has given us. If we want possession of the things that the Lord has promised, then we are going to have to be willing women to, like Caleb, take it by force. I want you to notice how in verse 12, Caleb is absolutely undeterred by the presence of the Anakim in the land of his inheritance. Now, this is an easy detail for us to miss over. So I want to tell you that this was a really big thing. If you remember back in our study of Numbers, the Anakim was this formidable race of these giant warlike people. And it was the sighting of these people that caused that original generation of Israelites to refuse to enter into the land, to rebel against God. When the scouts were originally sent into the land of Canaan, they saw these Anakin and they went back and they gave a bad report to the Israelites. They said, yeah, we saw the land. Yeah, it's a good land. There's really milk. There's really honey. But there are these people and they're huge. I mean, we're like grasshoppers in front of them. We don't have a chance. And then all of Israel decided to refuse to go into the land that God had promised them. So what we see here is that the very thing that caused the old generation to doubt God's promise was the thing that caused Caleb to actually hope in God's promise. What some saw as a discouragement, I think Caleb kind of saw as an adventure. I mean, this was prime real estate in the land of Canaan. This was the best of the land. And as a result, it was going to be the most difficult portion of Canaan to take possession of. But Caleb was just absolutely up for it at 85 years old. Women, I am 44 and I go to bed at 8:30 every night except Bible study. You're welcome. Caleb was so confident in the promise that God had made him. So the last thing that I want to point out regarding Caleb is how we see him in chapter 15 encouraging the fervor of the faith of others. In verse 16, Caleb said, "Whoever attacks and captures Kiriath Sefer, I will give my daughter Ashkah as a wife to him." So women, I know it is weird to us that Caleb offered his daughter in marriage to the first guy who sacked this city. And I think we tried in your study guide to prompt you to kind of push against the bounds of our cultural lens of thinking when considering this. I mean, it is weird to us now, but it wasn't weird to them then. And in fact, everything that we see in Scripture points to the fact that this deal kind of turned out pretty well for everyone. I mean, Ashkah, for one, did not at all seem bothered by this enragement. In fact, when the guy comes back and he's captured the city, and so now they have this prime piece of real estate, she gets off her donkey, she gives him a fist bump, and she's like, "Great, let's go see if I can get something else out of my dad," right? And she gets a brook and a field, okay? Now, ladies, we know very well that many of us are going to be begging our husbands to just mow the lawn this Easter weekend. So it doesn't seem at all such a bad deal to me to get a guy who is willing to sack an entire city for you. Right? As we carry on into the book of Judges, this exact same account is recorded in that first chapter. And we are going to see that this guy, Othniel, he goes on to become the first judge of Israel. So sometimes when we place the lens of our culture onto the text of Scripture, it causes us to see problems that weren't really there. And I just want us to be careful and to be aware when we might be doing that. So the most important thing from this whole section of Caleb is that he clearly saw that the land of God's promise was worth working for, worth fighting for, and worth dying for. And he passed that legacy of faith on to others. The next portrait of faith from this week's section of Scripture is that of our old friends, Mala, Micah, Noah, Hogla, and Tirzah, the daughters of Zelophehad. Now, I know all of you who studied Numbers were so excited to see these ladies show up again. So like Caleb, these women were among the few who actually came up to Joshua and just asked for the thing that they had been promised. And the stakes for these women were arguably even higher than they were for Caleb because they were women who usually did not stand to receive an inheritance of land. But back in Numbers 26 and 27, we saw that they came to Moses with what they perceived to be an injustice. Their father had no sons, just the five daughters. So as a result, their father's inheritance, when he died, was going to pass to his brothers. And they didn't understand how this was right. So they went to Moses and they said, hey, we think that we should get our father's land. And so Moses took it to the Lord, and astoundingly, the Lord agreed. We're going to see as we carry on into next week's scripture that outside of Caleb, these five women and the tribe of Levi, no one else asked for the thing that the Lord had promised them. Every other tribe and individual just waited for the lot to fall. And I'm not even sure I would necessarily even view that as a negative thing, except when we look at it in contrast to what we see here with these few individuals of those who were so eager for God's promise that they weren't about to just sit back and wait for their turn in line when the thing that they had been promised was right there and it was theirs to take. And I love that we have these five women as a shining example of that. And I also really love that unlike the other half of their tribe who somehow seemed content to settle just outside of the land that God had promised them, these five were intent on forging a way forward because they wanted that which the Lord had prepared for them. The final portrait of faith that we're given in this week's text is that of the tribe of Joseph in chapter 17. And when juxtaposed against the adventurous faith of Caleb and the insistent faith of Zelophehad's daughters, what we see in the tribe of Joseph is a faith of hesitant caution, which quite honestly provided me more of a mirror to my own faith than I would always even like to admit. But I think that this serves as a very good and healthy checkpoint for all of us. You see, Joseph's tribe wanted God to give them more than he had already given them before they had even done all the work that was necessary to take full possession of that which he had already given. They were very willing to take anything that they could gain easily, but they lacked the tenacity to push on deeper into the inheritance when things got hard. Much like Our Lady Scarlet, they were so preoccupied by what they didn't have that they failed to see the value of that which they already possessed. So as we kind of round out this week of study, I hope that you can see, looking at it as a whole, that there really is so much for us to take away this week. Scarlett certainly is not the only one whose father has prepared for her a bountiful inheritance. Nor is she the first or only child to foolishly neglect the inheritance that has been given. So as we close today, I encourage you to think of the things that God has promised that are meant for us right here and right now. And I think that you can ask him to bring just one thing to mind that you have not yet taken possession of. God has promised us victory over our sinful nature. So maybe there is an addiction or a stronghold or an insecurity that you harbor. God has promised us an abundant and a fruitful life and peace through our communion with him. So maybe it's fear or anxiety or discontentment that haunts you. Women, these promises represent in part the great inheritance that he has for his people. But as we have learned this week, we must take it. So let us not be content to just sit back and wait for the lot to fall, but let us be like Caleb and like Mala and Micah and Noah and Hogla and Tirzah, and let's go forward and let's ask the Lord to give us the thing that he has promised us, and then let us go forward fully aware and ready to fight for it.